behind that poetic veil the loftiest feelings and every possible perfection. Why, these three young ladies had to speak French and English on alternate days. Why, at a given time, they played, each in her turn, on the piano, the sound of which reached their brother's room where the students were at work. Why, those masters of French literature, music, drawing and dancing came to the house. Why, at certain hours, the three young ladies, accompanied by Mademoiselle Linon, were driven in a calèche to the Tverskoy Boulevard wearing satin cloaks, Dolly a long one, Natalie a somewhat shorter one, and Kitty so short a cloak that her shapely little legs in their tight red stockings were quite exposed. Why, they had to walk up and down the Tverskoy Boulevard, accompanied by a footman with a gilt cockade in his hat. All this and much more that happened in this mystic world he did not understand. But he knew that everything done there was beautiful, and he was in love with the very mystery of it all. In his student days he very nearly fell in love with the eldest daughter, Dolly. But a marriage was soon after arranged between her and Oblonsky. Then he began falling in love with the second daughter. He seemed to feel that he must fall in love with one of the sisters, but he was not sure with which. But Natalie, too, as soon as she came out, married the diplomat, Lvov. Kitty was still a child when Levin finished at the university. Young Shcherbatsky, who entered the navy, was drowned in the Baltic, and after that, in spite of his friendship with Oblonsky, Levin's intercourse with the Shcherbatskys became less frequent. But when he had come to Moscow early in the winter of this year and met them, he knew at last which of the three sisters he was really fated to love. It would seem that nothing could be simpler than for him, a man of good family, rich rather than poor, and 32 years of age, to propose to the Princess Shcherbatskaya. In all likelihood, he would have been considered quite a suitable match. But Levin was in love, and therefore Kitty seemed to him so perfect in every respect, so transcending everything earthly, and he seemed to himself so very earthly and insignificant a creature, that the possibility of his being considered worthy of her by others or by herself was to him unimaginable. Having spent 2 months in Moscow, living as in a fog, meeting Kitty almost every day in society, which he began to frequent in order to meet her, he suddenly made up his mind that it was impossible, and returned to the country. Levin's conviction that it was impossible rested on the idea that from her relatives' point of view he was not a good or suitable match for the delightful Kitty, and that Kitty herself could not love him. From her parents' standpoint, it seemed to him, he had no settled occupation or position in the world. He was 32, and while his former comrades were already colonels, aides-de-camp, bank and railway directors, or heads of government boards like Oblonsky, he knew very well what others must think of him, was merely a country squire, spending his time breeding cows, shooting snipe, and erecting buildings. That is to say, a fellow without talent, who had come to no good and was only doing what, in the opinion of society, good-for-nothing people always do. Of course the mysterious, enchanting Kitty could not love a plain fellow such as he considered himself to be, a man so ordinary and undistinguished. Moreover, his former relation to Kitty had been that of a grown-up man towards a child whose brother's friend he was, and this seemed an additional obstacle in love's path. He thought a plain, kindly fellow like himself might be loved as a friend, but to be loved with the kind of love he felt for Kitty, a man must be handsome and, above all, remarkable. He had heard that women often love plain, ordinary men, but he did not believe it because he judged by himself, and he could only love beautiful, mysterious, exceptional women. But after spending 2 months alone in the country, he became convinced that this time he was not in love as he had been when quite young, for his present feelings gave him not a moment's rest, and that he could not live unless the question whether she was to be his wife or not were decided. Also that his despair had been the outcome of his own fancy, and that he had no proof that he would be rejected. So he had now come to Moscow determined to propose to her, and to marry her if he was accepted. Or, but he dared not think what would happen if she refused him. Chapter 7. Having reached Moscow by a morning train, Lievin went to stay at the house of his half-brother, Koznishev, who was older than he, and after changing his clothes entered his brother's study, intending to tell him why he had come and to ask his advice. But his brother was not alone. A well-known professor of philosophy was with him, who had come specially from Kharkov to settle a dispute that had arisen between them on an important philosophical question. The professor was engaged in a fierce polemic against the materialists, and Sergius Koznishev, who followed this polemic with interest, on reading the professor's last article, had written to him reproaching him with having conceded too much to the materialists, and the professor had come at once to talk the matter over. The question was the fashionable one, whether a definite line exists between psychological and physiological phenomena in human activity, and if so, where it lies. When Lievin entered, Sergius Ivanich greeted him with the coldly affable smile he bestowed on everybody, and, having introduced him to the professor, went on with the discussion. The small, spectacled man with the narrow forehead interrupted the conversation a moment to say, "How do you do?" to Lievin, and paying no further attention to him, went on talking. Lievin sat down to wait till the professor should go, but soon became interested in the subject of their conversation. He had seen in the papers the articles they were discussing, and had read them because they interested him as a development of the bases of natural science, familiar to him as he had studied in that faculty at the university. But he had never connected these scientific deductions as to man's animal origin, reflex actions, biology and sociology, with those questions concerning the meaning to himself of life and death, which had of late more and more frequently occurred to him. Listening to his brother's conversation with the professor, he noticed that they connected the scientific question with the spiritual, and several times almost reached the latter. But every time they approached this, which seemed to him the most important question, they at once hurriedly retreated, and again plunged into the domain of fine subdivisions, reservations, quotations, hints and references to authorities, and he found it difficult to understand what they were talking about. "I cannot admit," said Koznishev, with his usual clear and precise expression and polished style, "I cannot on any account agree with Kais that my whole conception of the external world is the outcome of impressions. The most fundamental perception, that of existence, is not received through the senses, for there is no special organ to convey that perception." "Yes, but they, Wurst and Knaust and Pripasov, will tell you that your conception of existence results from the collective effect of all your sensations, and is, therefore, a result of sensations. Wurst actually says that without the senses there can be no perception of existence." "I would maintain the opposite," began Koznishev. But here again it seemed to Lievin that having reached the most important matter they avoided it, and he made up his mind to ask the professor a question. "Consequently, if my senses are destroyed, if my body dies, no further existence is possible?" he asked. The professor, vexed and apparently mentally hurt by the interruption, turned to look at this strange questioner who resembled a barge hauler rather than a philosopher, and then looked at Koznishev as if asking, "What can one say to this?" But Koznishev, who did not speak with anything like the same effort or as one-sidedly as the professor, and had room in his head for an answer to his opponent as well as for comprehension of the simple and natural point of view from which the question arose, smiled and said, "That question we have as yet no right to decide." "We have not the data," added the professor, and went back to his arguments. "No," said he, "I point out that if, as Pripasov definitely states, sensation is based on impressions, we must still carefully distinguish between these two perceptions." Lievin listened no longer, but sat waiting for the professor to go. Chapter 8. When the professor had gone, Koznishev turned to his stepbrother. I'm very glad you've come. Are you here for long? How'd you get on with your farming? Lievin knew that farming did not interest his elder brother, and that the question was merely a concession. Therefore he replied generally as to the sale of wheat and money matters. He wanted to tell his brother of his intended marriage and to ask his advice. He had even firmly made up his mind to do so, but when he saw his brother and heard his conversation with the professor, and afterward noticed the involuntarily patronizing tone in which he asked him about the business of their estate — this estate, which they had jointly inherited from their mother, had not been divided, and Lievin was managing the whole of it — he felt that something prevented him from beginning to speak to his brother about his intention to marry. He felt that his brother would not look at the matter as he wished him to. "Well, and how is your Zemtsvor getting on?" asked Koznishev, who took a keen interest in the rural administration and attached great importance to it.
"I really don't know."
"What? But you are a member."
"No, I am no longer on it. I resigned," answered Lievin, "and don't attend the meetings anymore."
"That's a pity," said Koznishev, and frowned. To justify himself, Lievin began to relate what used to happen at the meetings in his district.
"There now, it's always the same," interrupted Koznishev. "We Russians are always like that. It may be a good trait in us, this capacity to see our own faults, but we overdo it and comfort ourselves with sarcasm, which is always ready on our tongues. I can only tell you that with such rights as we have in our rural institutions, any other European nation, the English or the Germans, would have secured their freedom, while we only jeer at our Zemtsvos."
"But what is to be done?" said Lievin guiltily. "That was my last attempt, and I tried with my whole soul. But I can't do it. I'm incapable."
"Incapable?" said Koznishev. "No, you don't look at it from the right point of view."
"That may be," said Lievin, mournfully.
"Do you know that our brother Nikolai is here again?" Nikolai was Konstantin Lievin's elder brother and Koznishev's half-brother. He was a ruined man who had squandered the greater part of his fortune, mixed with the strangest and worst society, and quarrelled with his brothers.
"You don't mean to say so," cried Lievin, horror-struck.
"How do you know?"
"Prokofy met him in the street."
"Here, in Moscow? Where is he? Do you know?"
Lievin rose from his chair, as if meaning to go at once.
"I'm sorry I told you," said Koznishev, shaking his head at his brother's excitement. "I sent to find out where he is living, and forwarded him a note of hand he had given to Trubin, which I had paid. And this is the answer I received."
Koznishev took a note from under a paperweight and handed it to his brother. Lievin read the note, written in a curious but familiar hand. "I humbly beg you to leave me alone. That is all I demand of my dear brothers. Nikolai Lievin." When Lievin had read the note, holding it in his hand, he remained standing in front of Koznishev without lifting his head. A struggle was going on within him between the desire to forget his unfortunate brother for the present and the consciousness that this would be wrong.
"He evidently wants to offend me," continued Koznishev, "but he cannot do that. I wish with all my heart I could help him, but I know it can't be done."
"Yes, yes," said Lievin, "I understand and appreciate your attitude toward him, but personally I shall go to see him."
"Go if you like, but I don't advise it," said Koznishev. "That's to say, I'm not afraid of it on my own account. He'll not make mischief between us, but on your account I don't advise it."
"You'd better not go. It's impossible to help him."
"However, do as you please."
"It may be impossible to help him, but I feel, especially at this moment, but that's a different matter, I feel that I cannot be at peace."
"Well, I don't understand that," said Koznishev.
"But what I do understand is a lesson in humility. I have begun to look differently, more leniently, at what is called rascality since Brother Nikolai became what he is."
"Do you know what he's done?"
Oh, it's dreadful, dreadful, Lievin repeated.
Having got the address from Koznishev's footman, Lievin thought of going at once to see his brother, but on reflection decided to put off the visit till the evening. To obtain peace of mind, it was necessary first of all to decide the business that had brought him to Moscow. He therefore went to Oblonsky's office, and having received news of the Shcherbatskys, he drove to the place where he was told he could see Kitty. Chapter 9. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, Lievin, conscious that his heart was beating rapidly, got out of the hired sledge at the Zoological Gardens and went down the path leading to the ice hills and skating lake, sure of finding Kitty there, for he had noticed the Shcherbatskys' carriage at the entrance. It was a clear, frosty day. Carriages, private sledges, sledges for hire, and mounted police stood at the entrance. Well-dressed people, their hats shining in the sunlight, crowded at the gates and thronged the clean-swept paths between little houses built with carved eaves in Russian style. The bushy birch trees in the garden, with all their branches weighed down by snow, seemed attired in new festive garments. He walked along the path leading to the skating lake, and kept repeating to himself, "I must not be excited. I must be quiet." "What are you doing? What's the matter? Be quiet, stupid," he said to his heart. But the more he tried to be calm, the more laboured grew his breath. He met an acquaintance who called to him, but Lievin did not even notice who it was. He approached the ice hills and heard the clanking of the chains by which the sledges were being pulled up, their clatter as they descended the hills, and the sound of merry voices. A few more steps brought him to the skating lake, and among all the skaters he at once recognized her. He knew she was there by the joy and terror that took possession of his heart. She stood talking to a lady at the other end of the lake. There seemed to be nothing striking in her dress or attitude, but it was as easy for Lievin to recognize her in that crowd as to find a rose among nettles. Everything was lit up by her. She was the smile that brightened everything around. "Can I really step down onto the ice and go up to her?" he thought. The spot where she stood seemed to him an unapproachable sanctuary, and there was a moment when he nearly went away, he was so filled with awe. He had to make an effort and reason with himself that all sorts of people were passing near her, and he himself might have come just to skate. He stepped down, avoiding any long look at her as one avoids long looks at the sun, but seeing her as one sees the sun, without looking. On that day of the week and at that hour, people belonging to the same set and acquainted with one another met on the ice. Among them were masters of the art of skating showing off their skill, and beginners with timid and awkward movements holding on to the backs of chairs fitted with runners, boys and old men skating for hygienic reasons, and they all seemed to Lievin to be fortune's favourites because they were here, near her. Yet skaters appeared quite calmly to gain on her, to catch her up, and even speak to her, and quite independently of her to amuse themselves enjoying the excellent ice and the fine weather. Nikolai Shcherbatsky, Kitty's cousin, in a short jacket, tight trousers, with skates on his feet, was sitting on a bench, and seeing Lievin, called out to him,
"Hello, you Russian champion skater, when did you come? The ice is splendid. Put on your skates." "I haven't any skates," answered Lievin, wondering at such boldness and freedom of manner in her presence, and not losing sight of her for a moment, although not looking at her. He felt the sun approaching him. She was turning a corner. Her little feet, shod in high boots, kept close together, and she was skating timidly toward him. A little boy, dressed in a Russian costume, violently swinging his arms and stooping very low, was overtaking her. She was not very firm on her feet. Having drawn her hands from the muff that hung by a cord from her neck, she held them out, and looking at Lievin, whom she had recognized, she smiled at him and at her fears. Having turned the corner, she pushed off with an elastic little foot,
glided straight up to Shcherbatsky, and catching hold of him with her hand, nodded smilingly to Lievin. She was more beautiful than he had imagined her. When he thought about her, he could vividly picture to himself her entire person, and especially the charm of her small, fair-haired head, so lightly poised on the shapely, girlish shoulders, and the childlike brightness and kindness of her face. In that childlike look, combined with the slim beauty of her figure, lay her special charm, and this he thoroughly appreciated. But what always struck him afresh as unexpected was the expression of her eyes, mild, calm, and truthful, and above all her smile, which carried him into a fairyland where he felt softened and filled with tenderness, as he remembered feeling on rare occasions in his early childhood. "Have you been here long?" she said, shaking hands with him. "Thank you," she added, as he picked up the handkerchief she had dropped from her muff.
No, not long. Since yesterday. Today, replied Lievin, in his excitement not quite taking in her question. I wanted to come and see you, he went on. And then, remembering the reason why he wanted to see her, he became abashed and blushed. I did not know that you skated, and so well.
She looked attentively at him, as if wishing to understand his confusion.
Your praise is valuable. There is a tradition here that you are the best skater, she said, flicking off with a small black-gloved hand some hoar-frost crystals that had fallen on her muff.
Yes, I used to be passionately fond of skating. I wanted to be perfect at it.
You seem to do everything passionately, she remarked with a smile. I should so like to see you skate. Put on a pair and let us skate together.
Skate together? Can it be possible? Thought Lievin, looking at her.
I'll go and put them on at once, he said, and went to hire some skates.
You've not looked us up for a long time, sir, said one of the attendants, as, holding up Lievin's foot, he bored a hole in the heel of his boot. Since you left, we've had no gentleman who is such a master at it as you. Is that right? He added, pulling the strap tight.
Yes, that's right, that's right. Oh, please, be quick, answered Lievin, trying to restrain the happy smile which appeared on his face.
Yes, he thought, this is life. This is joy. She said, together, let us skate together. Shall I tell her now? Oh, but that's just why I'm afraid of speaking. Now I am happy, if only in my hopes. But I must. Away with this weakness.
He stood up, took off his overcoat, and having given himself a start on the rough ice near the shelter, glided down to the smooth surface of the lake, increasing and diminishing his speed and shaping his course as if by volition only. He approached Kitty timidly, but her smile again tranquilized him. She gave him her hand, and they went on together, increasing their speed, and the faster they went, the closer she pressed his hands.
"I should learn quicker with you. For some reason I feel confidence in you," she said.
"And I am confident of myself when you lean on me," he answered, and was immediately frightened of what he had said, and blushed.
And in fact, as soon as he had uttered these words, her face lost its kind expression, as when the sun hides behind a cloud, and Lievin noticed that familiar play of her features which indicated an effort of mind. A wrinkle appeared on her smooth forehead.
"Has anything unpleasant happened? Oh, but I have no right to ask," he said hurriedly.
"Why? No, nothing unpleasant has happened," she answered coldly, adding immediately, "You have not seen Mademoiselle Linon?"
"Not yet."
"Oh, go to her, then. She is so fond of you."
"What does she mean? I've hurt her." "Help me, O Lord," thought Lievin, hastening toward the old Frenchwoman with the grey curls who sat on one of the benches.
She welcomed Lievin as an old friend, showing her set of false teeth in a smile.
"Yes, you see we grow up," she said, indicating Kitty with a glance, "and grow old. tiny bear is grown up," continued the Frenchwoman, laughing and reminding him of his old joke when he called the three young ladies the three bears of the English fairy tale. "Do you remember when you used to call her so?"
He had not the faintest recollection of it, but she was fond of the joke, and had laughed at it for the last 10 years.
"Well, go, go and skate. Our Kitty is beginning to skate nicely, isn't she?"
When Levin returned to Kitty, her face was no longer stern, and her eyes had their former truthful, kindly look. But he thought there was an intentionally quiet manner in her affability, and he felt sad. Having spoken about her old governess and her peculiarities, she asked him about his way of life.
"Do you really manage not to feel dull in the country in winter?" she said.
"I don't feel at all dull. I'm very busy," he answered,
conscious that she was subduing him to her quiet tone, from which, as had happened at the beginning of the winter, he would not be able to free himself.
"Have you come for long?" asked Kitty.
"I don't know,"
he answered, without thinking of what he was saying. The idea that if he accepted her tone of calm friendliness he would again go away without having settled anything occurred to him, and he determined to rebel.
"You don't know?"
"I don't. It all depends on you," he said, and was at once terrified at his own words. Whether she had not heard his words or did not wish to hear them, anyhow, after slightly stumbling and striking her foot twice against the ice, she skated hurriedly away from him toward Mademoiselle Linon, said something to her, and went toward the little house where the ladies took off their skates.
"My God, what have I done? Oh, Lord, help me and teach me," prayed Levin.
And feeling at the same time a need of violent exercise, he got up speed and described inner and outer circles. Just then a young man, the best of the new skaters, with a cigarette in his mouth and skates on, came out of the coffee room, and taking a run, descended the steps leading to the lake, clattering with his skates as he jumped from step to step. He then flew down the slope and glided along the ice without so much as changing the easy position of his arms.
"Oh, that's a new trick," said Levin, and at once ran up to try that new trick.
"Don't hurt yourself. It needs practice," Nikolai Shcherbatsky called out.
Levin went up the path as far back as he could to get up speed, and then slid downwards, balancing himself with his arms in this unaccustomed movement. He caught his foot on the last step, but, scarcely touching the ice with his hand, made a violent effort, regained his balance, and skated away, laughing.
"Good. Dear man," thought Kitty, who at that moment was just coming out of the little house with Mademoiselle Linon, looking at him with a smile of gentle tenderness, as at a dear brother. "Can I really be guilty? Have I really done anything wrong? They say it's coquetting. I know it's not him I love, but still I feel happy with him. He is so charming. Only why did he say that?" she thought.
When he saw Kitty, who was going away, and her mother, who had met her on the steps, Levin, flushed with the violent exercise, stood still and considered. He then took off his skates and overtook mother and daughter at the gates of the gardens.
"Very pleased to see you," said the princess. "We are at home on Thursdays, as usual."
"And today is Thursday."
"We shall be glad to see you," said the princess, dryly.
Kitty was sorry to hear that dry tone, and could not resist the desire to counteract her mother's coldness. She turned her head and said smilingly, "Au revoir." Just then Oblonsky, his hat tilted on one side, with radiant face and eyes, walked into the gardens like a joyous conqueror. But on approaching his mother-in-law, he answered her questions about Dolly's health with a sorrowful and guilty air. After a few words with her in a subdued and mournful tone, he expanded his chest and took Levin's arm.
"Well, shall we go?" he asked.
I kept thinking about you, and am very, very glad you've come," he went on, looking significantly into Lievin's eyes.
"Yes, yes, let's go," answered the happy Lievin, still hearing the voice saying au revoir, and still seeing the smile with which it had been said.
"The Angleterre or the Hermitage?"
"I don't care."
"Well, then, the Angleterre," said Oblonsky, choosing the Angleterre because he was deeper in debt to that restaurant than to the Hermitage, and therefore considered it wrong to avoid it. "Have you a sledge? Oh, that's a good thing, because I've sent my coachman home." The two friends were silent all the way. Lievin was considering what the change in Kitty's face meant, now persuading himself that there was hope, now in despair, seeing clearly that such hope was madness, but yet feeling an altogether different being from what he had been before her smile and the words, au revoir. Oblonsky, during the drive, was composing the menu of their dinner.
"You like turbot, don't you?" he asked as they drove up to the restaurant.
"What?" said Lievin.
"Turbot? Oh, yes, I'm awfully fond of turbot."
Chapter 10.
When they entered the restaurant, Lievin could not help noticing something peculiar in his friend's expression, a kind of suppressed radiance in his face and whole figure. Oblonsky took off his overcoat and, with his hat on one side, walked into the dining room, giving his orders to the Tatar waiters in their swallowtail coats with napkins under their arms, who attached themselves to him, bowing right and left to his acquaintances, who, here as elsewhere, greeted him joyfully. He passed on to the buffet, drank a glass of vodka and ate a bit of fish as hors d'oeuvre, and said something to the painted Frenchwoman, bedecked with ribbons and lace, who sat at a little counter, something that made even this Frenchwoman burst into frank laughter. Lievin did not take any vodka, simply because that Frenchwoman, made up, as it seemed to him, of false hair, powder and toilet vinegar, was offensive to him. He moved away from her as from some dirty place. His whole soul was filled with Kitty's image, and his eyes shone with a smile of triumph and happiness.
"This way, please, Your Excellency, this way. No one will disturb Your Excellency here," said a specially officious waiter, an old white-headed Tartar, so wide in the hips that the tails of his coat separated behind.
"If you please, Your Excellency," he said, turning to Lievin, and as a mark of respect to Oblonsky, paying attention to his guest.
In a moment he had spread a fresh cloth on a round table already covered with a cloth beneath a bronze chandelier, moved two velvet chairs to the table, and stood with a napkin and menu awaiting the order.
"If Your Excellency would like a private room, one will be vacant in a few moments. Prince Golitsyn is there with a lady.
We've some fresh oysters in, sir?"
"Ah, oysters!"
Oblonsky paused and considered.
"Shall we change our plan, Lievin?" he said, with his finger on the bill of fare and his face expressing serious perplexity. "But are the oysters really good? Now, be careful.
Real Flensburg, Your Excellency. We've no Ostend ones.
They may be Flensburg, but are they fresh?"
"Well, they only arrived yesterday."
"Well, then, shall we begin with oysters and change the plan of our dinner, eh?"
"Oh, I don't mind. I like buckwheat porridge and cabbage soup best, but they don't have those things here."
"Would you like buckwheat à la Russe?" said the Tartar, stooping over Lievin like a nurse over a child.
"No. Joking apart, whatever you choose will suit me. I've been skating and I'm hungry. Don't think that I do not appreciate your choice," he added, noticing a dissatisfied look on Oblonsky's face. "I shall be glad of a good dinner."
"I should think so. Say what you like, it is one of the pleasures of life," said Oblonsky. "Well, then, my good fellow, bring us two... that'll be too little. 3 dozen oysters and vegetable soup."
"Printanier," chimed in the waiter.
But Oblonsky evidently did not wish to give him the pleasure of calling the dishes by their French names.
"Vegetable, you know. Then turbot with thick sauce. Then roast beef, and mind it's good. And then... capon, shall we say? Yes, and stewed fruit."
The waiter, remembering Oblonsky's way of calling the items on the French menu by their Russian names, did not repeat the words after him, but afterwards allowed himself the pleasure of repeating the whole of the order according to the menu. Potage printanier, turbo, sauce bon marché, poulard à l'estragon, macédoine des fruits. And immediately, as if moved by springs, he put down the bill of fare in one cardboard cover, and seizing another containing the wine list, held it out to Oblonsky. "What should we have to drink?"
"Whatever you like, only not too much."
"Or champagne?" said Levin.
"What, to begin with?"
"However, why not? You like the white seal?"
"Cachet blanc," chimed in the waiter.
"Yes, bring us that with the oysters, and then we'll see."
"Yes, sir. And what sort of table wine?"
No, let's have the classic Chablis."
"Yes, sir. And your special cheese?"
"Well, yes, a Parmesan.
Or do you prefer some other kind?"
"No, I really don't care," said Levin, unable to restrain a smile. The Tartar darted off, his coat-tails flying, and 5 minutes later rushed in again with a dish of opened oysters in pearly shells and a bottle between his fingers. Oblonsky crumpled his starched napkin and pushed a corner of it inside his waistcoat, then, with his arms comfortably on the table, attacked the oysters.
"Not bad," he said, pulling the quivering oysters out of their pearly shells with a silver fork and swallowing one after another. "Not bad," he repeated, lifting his moist and glittering eyes now to Levin, now to the Tartar.
Levin could eat oysters, though he preferred bread and cheese, but it gave him more pleasure to watch Oblonsky. Even the Tartar, who, having drawn the cork and poured the sparkling wine into the thin, wide glasses, was straightening his white tie, glanced with a smile of evident pleasure at Oblonsky.
"You don't care much for oysters?" said Oblonsky, emptying his champagne glass. "Or perhaps you're thinking of something else, eh?"
He wanted Levin to be in good spirits, but Levin, if not exactly in bad spirits, felt constrained. The feelings that filled his heart made him ill at ease and uncomfortable in this restaurant with its private rooms where men took women to dine. Everything seemed offensive. These bronzes, mirrors, gaslights, and Tartar waiters. He was afraid of soiling that which filled his soul.
"I? Yes, I am preoccupied. And besides, all this makes me feel constrained," he said. "You can't imagine how strange it all seems to me who live in the country. Like the nails of that gentleman I saw at your place."
"Yes, I noticed that poor Grinyevich's nails interested you greatly," said Oblonsky.
"I can't help it," replied Levin. "Put yourself in my place. Look at it from a country fellow's point of view. We try to get our hands into a state convenient to work with, and for that purpose we cut our nails and sometimes roll up our sleeves. But here people purposely let their nails grow until they begin to curl, and have little saucers for studs to make it quite impossible for them to use their hands."
Oblonsky smiled merrily.
"Yes, it is a sign that rough work is unnecessary to him. He works with his mind."
"Possibly. But still it seems to me strange that while we country people try to get over our meals as quickly as we can so as to be able to get on with our work, here you and I try to make our meal last as long as possible, and therefore eat oysters."
"Well, of course," said Oblonsky. "The aim of civilization is to enable us to get enjoyment out of everything."
"Well, if that is its aim, I'd rather be a savage."
"You are a savage as it is. All you Levins are savages."
Levin sighed. He remembered his brother, Nikolai, and frowned, feeling ashamed and distressed. But Oblonsky started a subject which at once distracted his thoughts.
"Well, are you going to see our people tonight? The Shabatskys, I mean," he said, pushing away the rough and now empty oyster shells and drawing the cheese toward him while his eyes glittered significantly.
"Yes, certainly I shall go, though the princess appeared to ask me rather unwillingly.
"'Not a bit of it. What humbug? It's just her manner. Come, bring us that soup, my good fellow. It's her grande dame manner,' said Oblonsky. "'I shall come, too, but I must first go to a musical rehearsal at the Countess Bonin's. "'What a strange fellow you are, though. "'How do you explain your sudden departure from Moscow? "'The Shabatskys asked me again and again, just as if I ought to know all about you. "'Yet all I know is that you never do things as anyone else does.'
"'Yes,' said Levin, slowly and with agitation. "'You are right. I am a savage. "'Only my savagery lies not in having gone away then, "'but rather in having come back now. "'I have now come—'
"'Oh, what a lucky fellow you are!'
interrupted Oblonsky, looking straight into his eyes.
"'Why?' "'Fiery steeds by something brands I can always recognize. "'Youths in love at once I know by the look that lights their eyes,' declaimed Oblonsky. "'You have everything before you.'
"'And you? Have you everything behind you?'
"'No, not—' "'Behind me, but you have the future, and I have the present. "'And even that only half and half.
"'Why?'
"'Oh, things are rather bad. "'However, I don't want to talk about myself, "'and besides, it's impossible to explain everything,' said Oblonsky. "'Well, and why have you come to Moscow? "'Here, take this away,' he shouted to the Tartar.
"'Don't you guess?' answered Levin, the light shining deep in his eyes as he gazed steadily at Oblonsky.
"'I do, but I can't begin to speak about it. "'By which you can judge whether my guess is right or wrong,' said Oblonsky, looking at him with a subtle smile.
"'Well, and what do you say to it?' asked Levin with a trembling voice, feeling that all the muscles of his face were quivering. "'What do you think of it?'
Oblonsky slowly drank his glass of Chablis, his eyes fixed on Levin.
"'There is nothing I should like better,' said he.
"'Nothing. It is the best that could happen.
"'But are you not making a mistake? Do you know what we're talking about?' said Levin, peering into his interlocutor's face. "'You think it possible?'
"'I think so. Why shouldn't it be?'
"'No, do you really think it is possible?
"'No, you must tell me all you really think. "'And suppose a refusal is in store for me. "'I am even certain—'
"'Why do you think so?' said Oblonsky, smiling at Levin's excitement.
"'Well, sometimes it seems so to me. "'You know, that would be terrible, both for her and for me.'
"'Oh, no. In any case, there's nothing in it terrible for the girl. Every girl is proud of an offer.
Yes, every girl, but not she.
Oblonsky smiled. He understood that feeling of Levin's so well, knew that for Levin all the girls in the world were divided into two classes. One class included all the girls in the world except her, and they had all the usual human failings and were very ordinary girls, while the other class, herself alone, had no weaknesses and was superior to all humanity.
"'Oh, wait a bit, you must take some sauce,' said Oblonsky, stopping Levin's hand that was pushing away the sauce-boat.
Levin obediently helped himself to sauce, but would not let Oblonsky eat.
"'No, wait. Wait,' he said. "'Understand that for me it is a question of life and death. "'I have never spoken to anyone about it, and can speak to no one else about it. "'Now, you and I are quite different in everything, in tastes and views and everything. "'But I know you like me and understand me, and so I am awfully fond of you, but for God's sake be quite frank with me.'
"'I am telling you what I think,'
said Oblonsky, smiling, "and I'll tell you something more. My wife is a most wonderful woman." He sighed, remembering his relations with his wife. Then, after a minute's pause, he continued, "She has the gift of clairvoyance. She sees people through and through, but more than that, she knows what is going to happen, especially in regard to marriages. For instance, she predicted that the Shakovskaya girl would marry Brenteln. Oh, no one would believe it, but as it turned out, she was right. And she is on your side."
"How do you know?"
"In this way. She not only likes you, but says that Kitty is sure to be your wife."
At these words, a sudden smile brightened Lievin's face, the kind of smile that is not far from tears of tenderness.
"She says that?" he cried. "I have always thought her a jewel, your wife. But enough. Enough about it." And he got up. "All right, but sit down."
But Lievin could not sit still. He strode up and down the little cage of a room, blinking to force back his tears, and only when he had succeeded did he sit down again.
"Try and realize," he said, "that this is not love. I have been in love, but this is not the same thing. It is not my feeling, but some external power that has seized me. I went away, you know, because I had come to the conclusion that it was impossible, you understand? Because such happiness does not exist on earth. But I have struggled with myself and found that without that there's no life for me. And it must be decided."
"Then why did you go away?"
"Hey, wait a moment. Oh, what a crowd of ideas. How many things I have to ask. Listen, you can't imagine what you have done for me by saying what you did. I am so happy that I'm acting meanly. I've forgotten everything. I heard today about my brother Nikolai. He's here, you know. And I forgot all about him. It seems to me as if he too were happy. It is like madness. But there is one awful thing about it. You, who are married, know the feeling. It is awful that we, who are comparatively old and have pasts, not of love, but of sin, suddenly we come into close intimacy with a pure, innocent being. That is disgusting, and therefore one can't help feeling oneself unworthy. Well, there haven't been many sins in your past."
"Ah, but all the same," said Lievin, "looking back at my life, I tremble and curse and bitterly regret. Yet, what's to be done? That's the way the world is made," said Oblonsky.
"My one consolation is that prayer that I like so much. Not according to my deserts, but according to thy mercy. And she too can only forgive me that way."
Chapter 11. Lievin emptied his glass, and they were silent for a while.
"There is one thing more that I must tell you," began Oblonsky. "You know Vronsky?"
"No, I don't. Why do you ask?"
"Another bottle,"
said Oblonsky, turning to the Tartar, who was filling their glasses and hovering round them just when he was not wanted.
"The reason you ought to know Vronsky is this. He's one of your rivals."
"What is he?" asked Lievin, the expression of childlike rapture which Oblonsky had been admiring suddenly changing into an angry and unpleasant one.
"Vronsky is one of Count Ivanovich Vronsky's sons, and a very fine sample of the gilded youth of Petersburg. I met him in Tver when I was in the service there, and he came on conscription duty. Awfully rich, handsome, with influential connections, an aide-de-camp to the Emperor, and at the same time very good-natured, a first-rate fellow. And he's even more than a first-rate fellow. As I've got to know him now, he turns out to be both educated and very clever. A man who will go far."
Lievin frowned and was silent.
Well, so he came here soon after you left, and as far as I can make out, is head over ears in love with Kitty. And you understand that her mother...
Pardon me, but I understand nothing, said Lievin, dismally knitting his brows. And at once he thought of his brother Nikolai and how mean he was to forget him.
You just wait a bit, wait,
said Oblonsky, smiling and touching Lievin's arm.
I have told you what I know, and I repeat that, as far as anyone can judge in so delicate and subtle a matter, I believe the chances are all on your side.
Lievin leant back in his chair. His face was pale.
But I should advise you to settle the question as soon as possible,
Oblonsky continued, filling Lievin's glass. No thanks, I can't drink any more, said Lievin, pushing his glass aside, or I shall be tipsy.
Well, and
how are you getting on? He continued, evidently wishing to change the subject.
One word more. In any case, I advise you to decide the question quickly, but I shouldn't speak today, said Oblonsky. Go tomorrow morning and propose in the classic manner, and may heaven bless you. You have so often promised to come and shoot with me. Why not come this spring? Said Lievin.
He now repented with his whole heart of having begun this conversation with Oblonsky. His personal feelings had been desecrated by the mention of some Petersburg officer as his rival, and by Oblonsky's conjectures and advice. Oblonsky smiled. He understood what was going on in Lievin's soul.
I'll come some day, he said. Oh, old chap, women are the pivot on which everything turns. Things are in a bad way with me, too. Very bad. And all on account of women. Tell me, quite frankly.
He took out a cigar, and with one hand on his glass, he continued,
Give me some advice.
Why? What is the matter?
Well, it's this. Supposing you were married and loved your wife, but had been fascinated by another woman.
Excuse me, but really,
it's quite incomprehensible to me. It's as if, just as incomprehensible as if I, after eating my fill here, went into a baker's shop and stole a roll.
Oblonsky's eyes glittered more than usual.
Why not? Rolls sometimes smell so that one can't resist them. Himmlisch ist's, wenn ich bezwungen meine irdische Begier, aber doch, wenn's nicht gelungen, hat ich auch recht hübsch Plaisir.
Oblonsky repeated these lines with a subtle smile, and Lievin himself could not help smiling.
No, but joking apart, continued Oblonsky, just consider. A woman, a dear, gentle, affectionate creature, poor and lonely, sacrifices everything. Now, when the thing is done, just consider, should one forsake her? Granted that one ought to part with her so as not to destroy one's family life, but oughtn't one to pity her and provide for her and make things easier?
As to that, you must pardon me. You know that for me there are two kinds of women, or rather, no, there are women and there are... I have never seen any charming fallen creatures, and never shall see any. And people like that painted Frenchwoman with her curls out there by the counter are an abomination to me, and all these fallen ones are like her.
And the one in the Gospels? Oh, don't. Christ would never have spoken those words had he known how they would be misused. They are the only words in the Gospels that seem to be remembered. However, I'm not saying what I think, but what I feel. I have a horror of fallen women. You are repelled by spiders, and I by those creatures. Probably you never studied spiders and know nothing of their morals, and it's the same in my case.
It's all very well for you to talk like that. It's like that gentleman in Dickens who, with his left hand, threw all difficult questions over his right shoulder.
But denying a fact is no answer. What am I to do?
Tell me, what am I to do? My wife is getting old, and I am full of vitality.
A man hardly has time to turn round before he feels that he can no longer love his wife in that way, whatever his regard for her may be. And then, all of a sudden, love crosses your path, and you're lost.
Lost, said Oblonsky with despair.
Levin smiled.
Yes, I am lost, continued Oblonsky.
But what am I to do?
Don't steal rolls.
Oblonsky burst out laughing.
Oh, you moralist! But just consider, here are two women. One insists only on her rights, and her rights are your love, which you cannot give her. And the other sacrifices herself and demands nothing. What are you to do? How are you to act? It is a terrible tragedy.
If you want me to say what I think of it, I can only tell you that I don't believe in the tragedy. And the reason is this. I think love, both kinds of love, which you remember Plato defines in his Symposium, both kinds of love serve as a touchstone for men. Some men understand only the one, some only the other. Those who understand only the non-Platonic love need not speak of tragedy. For such love, there can be no tragedy. Thank you kindly for the pleasure, goodbye, and that's the whole tragedy. And for the Platonic love, there can be no tragedy either, because there everything is clear and pure, because... Here, Levin, recollecting his own sins and the inner struggle he had lived through, added unexpectedly,
However, maybe you're right. It may very well be, but I don't know, I really don't know.
Well, you see, you are very consistent, said Oblonsky. It is both a virtue and a fault in you. You have a consistent character yourself, and you wish all the facts of life to be consistent, but they never are. For instance, you despise public service because you want work always to correspond to its aims, and that never happens. You also want the activity of each separate man to have an aim, and love and family life always to coincide, and that doesn't happen either. All the variety, charm, and beauty of life are made up of light and shade. Levin sighed and did not answer. He was thinking of his own affairs and not listening to Oblonsky. And suddenly both felt that though they were friends and had dined and drunk wine together, which should have drawn them yet closer, yet each was thinking only of his own affairs and was not concerned with the other. Oblonsky had more than once experienced this kind of acute estrangement instead of union following a dinner with a friend, and knew what to do in such a case.
"The bill!"
he shouted, and went out into the dining hall, where he immediately saw an aide-de-camp of his acquaintance, and entered into conversation with him about an actress and her protector. And immediately in conversation with the aide-de-camp, Oblonsky felt relief and rest after the talk with Levin, who always demanded of him too great a mental and spiritual strain. When the Tartar returned with a bill for 26 rubles odd, Levin quite unconcernedly paid his share, which with the tip came to 14 rubles, a sum that usually would have horrified his rustic conscience, and went home to dress and go on to the Shabatskys, where his fate was to be decided.
Chapter 12 Princess Kitty Shcherbatskaya was 18, and this was her first season. Her success in society was greater than that of her two elder sisters, and greater even than her mother had expected. Not only were nearly all the youths that danced at the Moscow balls in love with Kitty, but two serious suitors presented themselves for her that very first winter. Levin, and, immediately after his departure, Count Vronsky. Levin's arrival at the beginning of the winter, his frequent visits and evident love for Kitty, gave rise to her parents' first serious deliberation as to her future, and to disputes between them. The prince took Levin's part and said he desired nothing better for Kitty. The princess, with a woman's way of talking round the question, said that Kitty was too young, that Levin had not shown that his intentions were serious, that Kitty was not in love with him, and so on. But she did not say the most important things,
namely that she expected a better match for her daughter, that she did not like Lievin and did not understand him. When he suddenly left,